Well, my guest in the studio tonight started playing classical and flamenco guitar, but he's probably best known for his work with the band Dig, or Directions in Groove. He studied jazz at the New South Wales Conservatorium in the early 1980s, before working in a number of areas, including rock and cabaret, prior to forming Dig. After riding the wave of popularity with Dig in the 1990s, he went to New York City to study with guitarists Peter Bernstein and Steve Cardenas. Since returning, he's worked with the who's who of Australian jazz scene and on most of the major jazz stages here in Australia. He's just released a trio album called U-Tunes on the Rufus Record label. Tim Rollinson, welcome to Now's the Time.
Thanks very much, Frank. Thanks for having me in.
Tim, you started playing classical and flamenco guitar, as I mentioned in the intro. Tell us how you discovered jazz music and who were your early influences.
In a sense, jazz was my first choice in some ways, because when I started playing the guitar, it was my dad had actually sort of bought a guitar while the rest of the family had been away for a couple of months. And when we got back, it was like there was this guitar just sitting there, and he actually just never got around to learning it. So there was a guitar and a classical guitar book. So I kind of thought, wow, you know, that's fantastic. So I just started playing it, and then I became interested, and basically Mum said, well, you know, do you want to go for lessons? Because there was nobody in the family that could actually give me any tips. I was sure that'd be great. And that's kind of how it all started. But, I mean, I was a big music fan as far as listening went. I think it was when I heard certain players, like the classical world never really kind of captured me that particularly that well.
This is the 1970s, Tim?
It is, yeah. Well, it was, yeah. The first, there was a sort of like the kind of rock thing, obviously. That was huge in those days, you know, and I just listened to radio all the time. I used to love vocal music previous to all that, vocal harmony music. I was just thinking about the other day. My family also lived in New Zealand for a couple of years, and there was a lot of Motown and sort of 50s sort of and 60s kind of vocal harmony stuff on the radio there, and I remember just being captured by that. To me, it was just like incredible. It was like angel singing or something when I'd hear that. And I think that was one of the things that really sparked my interest in just a certain sound that really captured me. You know, I had a few albums, a few rock albums. I was into sort of like all sorts of things. I became kind of interested in some of the kind of progressive rock stuff. I loved like Cat Stevens and that kind of thing as well. I went out and bought I can't even remember why I did it, actually, although my dad did have like a Stan Getz album, and he loved Frank Sinatra. So as well as all this other stuff I'm mentioning, there was quite a lot of swing stuff played in the house.
So it sounds like melody was at the forefront of your initial tastes.
I think so, and harmony too, like just that sort of rich harmony. You know, I kind of loved. I couldn't really go into all the different kinds of music I was listening to back then, because it was just like my ears were just open to anything and everything. You know, anything that the first jazz guitar album that I bought, and as I say, I'm not exactly sure why I bought it, but I guess I was playing the guitar and maybe somebody mentioned it to me. But it was a Joe Pass album, called Intercontinental, which I still got lying around somewhere, the old vinyl copy of it, which is a beautiful album.
Do you think you've been influenced more by jazz guitarists than, say, other instrumentalists?
At first, I guess I was sort of interested in learning more about the guitar itself, and I guess I was exposed to that through all the various rock bands, and there was a lot of guitarists obviously on show, and you know. But as time went on, I became more interested in other instruments. I became, like, as soon as I heard like Miles Davis, Coltrane, Ornette Coleman, you know, the list goes on as you discover more and more. And I guess I found I went through a bit of a fusion, like the sort of 70s jazz fusion period, and that's what led me to those people. Because I guess one of the records that I really loved was Blow by Blow, the Jeff Beck album. And then after sort of listening to that, it was kind of like Tom Scott and the LA Express, and people like Robin Ford and Larry Carlton, sort of exposed to those sort of people. And then John McLaughlin. And that's a big turning point, I think, because then you go, oh, what else has this guy done? And then you sort of discover the Miles Davis rock albums.
Yeah, it all changes after that.
That's right, yeah, and it sort of gets deeper and heavier and more exciting, you know, and somehow, like, a lot of things get sort of...
And then who has Miles played with? And
exactly,
and it
yeah.
goes on
yeah.
and on, doesn't it?
Yeah, and it
blossoms after that.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you think there are closer bonds between guitarists than with, say, other instrumentalists?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, it's hard for me to say, because I don't really play any other instrument. I did play some cello. I think cellos are pretty tight, you know. But in a way, it's funny, because cello, I only realised this later, cello and guitar are virtually, they're both string instruments, and they basically have the same register, playing basically in the same group of notes. I think guitarists tend to sort of like kind of discussing things and getting together.
Mm.
I mean, I'm actually in a band called the 10 Guitar Orchestra, which is run by
David Reiston.
The 10 Guitar Project. And I guess with horn players, you know, you may find yourself in a horn section at times. So you're kind of interacting, like both musically and backstage. But there's often just one guitarist.
One guitarist, that's right.
So, you know, you align yourself with the rhythm section perhaps a little and kind of discuss things. But horn players are kind of used to that group thing, I think. But the interesting thing I found about having 10 guitarists together, I thought it would just be sort of a crazy mess. But it seems to have worked out really well. And as well as that, I think we all get along as people really well.
Yeah.
So that is interesting. I guess it certainly doesn't disprove your theory.
It's a nice album, that one. What especially feeds your inspiration to enable you to compose music?
I mean, composing is something that I've sort of feel kind of compelled to do, I guess. I always have. I mean, even when I had no idea how to compose, it's like when I was in the early days, I was kind of trying to put chord progressions together. Again, as I say, it was there was nobody that I could directly sort of learn from in the early times. I had a guitar teacher, but he was a classical teacher who didn't really, I mean, he was a classical and flamenco player. And then another guitar teacher came along, took over the business, and I remained with this guy, who was actually a classical player, but he also played some jazz. And that was kind of like my opening. But the weird thing was, he was actually really resistant to trying to teach me anything about it, so I really had to work hard to get any information out of him at all, which, in retrospect, I can't work out why that was, but that was the situation. And it wasn't like I was an amazing classical guitarist, because, you know, I didn't really practice a lot. I went up to about sixth grade, I think, and that was kind of enough for me. I was kind of into other things by then, but, you know, it was enjoyable. I mean, I learnt to read through doing that, you know, which has been really useful as time's gone on. And but the main thing for me as a teenager was being in this band called the Young Northside Big Band, which came along at roughly that same time that I was trying to extract information from my teacher. Northside Big Band started at my high school and then went on to kind of have a life outside of that, and we were sort of taken under John Spate's wing, and John Spate was the guy who eventually went on to run the Manly Jazz Festival.
That's right. And of course, that particular band was a great nurturing ground for so many big names now in Australian jazz.
Certainly was. I mean, at one point the band had, you know, Dale Barlow, Trevor Griffin, James Morrison. It had Lloyd Swanson, Chris Abrahams, believe it or not, Andrew Gander. So basically, I mean, if anybody remembers the Benders, which was like the band pre-Necks, that was basically, it wasn't directly as a result of the Northside Big Band, but all those people met each other through that band and then went on to kind of form their own band.
Mm. Sort of a similar thing to what Judy Bailey is doing to this day with her Jazz Connection, I guess.
Yeah, that's right.
A piece which is jointly written, a little bit of a improvised piece, this one. Is that right, Tim?
That's right.
It's called E Squared. Can you tell us what the feeling was when you went into this piece?
Well, I could let you in on a little secret here. In actual fact, this was like a spontaneous ending to another song. That version of that song I didn't end up using. I used a different version, but I really liked what we did spontaneously. So I thought, and it's just a little thing, it's like a minute and a half long. It's completely off the cuff. And therefore, I sort of thought, well, there's a certain spirit about it which I really like. I mean, I wish I could play more like this all the time, to be honest. But I was sort of glad that it was captured. And there's something about it, I just feel it's like it's kind of a personal kind of thing. It sounds like, to me, it sounds like, well, as I say, if I could sort of play along these lines all the time, I think that would be really satisfying.
When you started that band Dig, did you ever in your wildest dreams think that it would take off the way it did?
No. It's a short answer to that question. I mean, we were just doing it for fun, so we didn't have any grand plan. I mean, it was just a case of a few people meeting up, having similar ideas after having been playing in Sydney for a few years, all kind of like people that had sort of a large interest in jazz, but, you know, had like sort of other things, other interests musically as well. And we just kind of got together and started throwing a few ideas around. And it was also a product of its time as well as anything else, because there were quite, I mean, the Sydney live scene has been difficult for musicians for quite some time now. And at that particular time, like in the early 90s, there was quite a lot of work, bizarrely, in nightclubs. You know, they had bands, I don't know why. It was almost like one of the few places you, and especially if you weren't a rock band, you know, the nightclubs would sort of have some degree of jazz stuff, some kind of hip-hoppy stuff, some sort of funk bands.
So for want of a better term, I suppose the acid jazz thing was sort of happening in London and New York, and
yeah, well, exactly,
and was sort of like a spin-off from
yeah, and I can't say that we weren't unaware of that. I mean, obviously, like that was it was being played. You know, in clubs, and it was also sort of pumping out of inner city, you know, record stores when they still used to have records available and CDs. But, you know, bizarrely enough, when you think about it now, like CDs had only been around for a few years at that point, so vinyl was still kind of going.
Yeah,
and you know, and you could walk past, you could sort of walk around the city, and you could hear like this kind of funky music that, and you know, obviously the Talkin' Loud label and the acid jazz label were sort of quite popular, and a lot of DJs were springing up playing that kind of thing, and then they'd mix it up with older tracks like stuff from the 60s and 70s, and so you had like the new stuff, and then you had like mixed in with a lot of old stuff. So there was all, and then you know, and there was the kind of Herbie Hancock sort of Miles sort of part of it as well. So it was kind of an interesting, exciting time, really, because all of a sudden, you know, form a band, and we sort of started with a couple of residencies, you know, which was great at the time. We played at Kinsella's when that was still
right.
kind of more of a nightclub. Now it's more of a pubby sort of feel to it with pokies and, but you know, at that time, it was just people and pool tables,
and
a band in the corner, and it was quite good. And we just built and built and built, you know, and that was the. You sort of asked, did we sort of know that? Certainly, had no idea when we started, but as it started to build, it was like, whoa, you know, like, what's going on? Because as a musician, you're kind of used to it often going the other way. You know, you might start a gig and, you know, it sort of maybe has a life and then it kind of peters out. Well,
That's
this
right.
just kept on going and going and going. It's almost like we had to, eventually, we moved upstairs where the capacity was bigger. We actually preferred playing downstairs, to be honest, because it just had a more lively sort of feeling, and it was nice. But upstairs felt more like a venue.
I'm pretty sure I made it to one of those gigs in the 90s. But this afternoon I dug through some of my archives, and I found myself a copy of the Australian Jazz and Blues magazine in 1994. It's a now defunct magazine. Diggs on the front cover, and there you are back in 1994 with a big grin on your face. And no wonder at the time you're riding a wave of popularity. But
that was our kind of peak, really, like the 94, 95, possibly 96, and
I flipped to the article and was a little bit disappointed. It's a little lightweight, but there is one interesting question, and I thought I might raise that with you. I don't know who the writer of this was, by the way, but I guess it was the editor of the magazine at the time. But they're saying here, whilst their music is not new, it is to an audience which was not weaned on the fusion jazz of the 60s and 70s. This virgin audience is hearing for the first time the music of the artists that inspired Dig. This raises an important issue. Will this audience become lifelong avid fans of jazz-influenced music? Well, lifelong might be a little hard to reach, but...
We were not darlings of the critics in any stretch of the imagination. In fact, all the critics basically said bad things about us whenever they could. Any compliment was always backhanded, so there was always a proviso with every reasonable comment. I remember seeing like one critic. We did an outdoor concert at the steps of the Opera House, and I think it was the Telecom or Telstra.
Oh, that's
jazz.
Sydney Telstra,
yeah,
that's
and
the Bulls, right?
And Max Roach.
That's right.
Band was
very
playing.
Very windy day,
and we were on before we were sort of like the support. And we actually brought quite a lot of people down, you know, and they were kind of dancing. And then, but as we were arriving, I remember seeing like this reasonably famous Sydney jazz critic disappearing, like going away from the venue, basically walking, you know, he was like about a kilometre away or so, heading in the opposite direction. And then we played, and then a lot of our audience sort of stuck around. And in fact, like, I mean, you would imagine Max Roach would draw a huge audience, but there weren't a lot of people there, and it was, in a way, it was just as well that we played first, because there was all this, a lot of people came to see us and then stuck around and loved it, and people just kept on dancing, you know. And so that was interesting to see people dancing to the Max Roach quartet or quintet. So, I mean, you know, so things can cross over and things can coexist, you know, and maybe people did. Some people might have gotten into Max Roach that day who never would have heard him, you know. But then we were reviewed by this critic who I'm sure wasn't even there. So it was just stuff like that just constantly happened. And so in the end, it was kind of like water off a duck's back. Like, we were just sort of not really too worried about what critics were saying, because it seemed that they couldn't say anything good. And all we sort of felt was that we were just a band and we were playing music, and sure, we were influenced by jazz, and I think we had every right to be, since we'd all played mainstream and jazz
and studied
before
at the conservatorium.
You know, before we formed this band. So it wasn't like we just kind of started at that point. We had one of the best drummers in the country, in my opinion, you know, and I played with Andrew Gander and Tony Buck, you know, and I played with lots of other drummers, you know, Lawrence Pike, Jamie Cameron, Evan Minnell, Hamish Stewart, the list goes on. And I think Terrapi is an amazing drummer. He's actually on tour with Marcus Miller as we speak. And then there was Alex Hewitson on bass, who is highly credentialed jazz player and funk player. So everyone's got a right not to like it, but I felt we had an undue amount of criticism, really, you know, considering that we weren't trying to kind of take anything over.
Well, that was going to be my question, and you're probably well placed to answer it. Has part of your original audience become fans of jazz-influenced music? I mean, do you have a feeling on that, or...?
Well, I think it's true. I mean, like, definitely to some point. I mean, obviously, I can't really tell how much. I mean, I guess I won't mention any names in case they wouldn't want me to say it. But, like, there's like, quite a famous jazz pianist in Sydney who loved the band, you know, when he's, like, 15 years younger than me kind of thing. He was, like, a teenager when the band started. He loved the band, and he has fond memories of it. You know, when you come from country areas and stuff, like, sometimes I think we were one of the few bands that actually made it onto the radio in certain areas of the country and overseas as well. And there's a jazz guitarist of quite some renown who said the first jazz guitar that he ever heard was some of my stuff on the Dig recordings. Sometimes we're introduced, and I wouldn't take any credit for how well somebody plays, but at the same time, I mean, it's nice that that's what happens, isn't it? I mean, you do your best to get out there, and sometimes it's sort of nice to get some sort of feedback.
Well, you must have learned a number of lessons on how to manage the business end of the music business with the success of Dig. What should jazz musicians be doing better in relation to getting heard?
Well, that's a really difficult question, because the whole recorded music and live scene has changed since those times. I mean, in Dig's case, we were very lucky to be in the right place at the right time, and we kind of did it first. And there were a lot of other bands sort of catching on to that kind of idea at the time. It's like we sort of got it together just at the right time. And we had like certain elements that proved to work. I mean, there were other bands that were similar, but they were a bit more rocky.
Some of your history playing jazz in the 1980s, and I know you played with the singer Joe Lane.
Yes, I did a bit of stuff with Joe.
You must have some fantastic stories, experiences with Joe.
Well, yeah. I think anybody that's worked with him would have fantastic stories, and there were stories galore before I started playing the guitar. You know, but the thing was, I really sort of met Joe in his latter days. So I didn't see him, you know, at his complete and utter pomp when he was busking to Melbourne with a drum kit and all that kind of stuff that you hear, all those amazing stories. I saw him, the first time I heard Joe sing was at the Paris Theatre. They used to have some jazz concerts there, and he came out in the middle of somebody else's set, and I was just floored. Me, I'd never known that this person ever existed, and it was incredible. And then I sort of in the early 80s, there was the Criterion gig.
Yes.
Do you remember that one?
Yeah. Yep.
Where you know, people would sit in
Warwick Alder and
lots of. I mean, sometimes there'd be about like 20 saxophone players lined up around the room, all waiting to play 10 choruses. You know, the rhythm changes, but you know, Joe took it all in his stride, and you know, as well as all that, he had that sort of. He was an amazing bebop singer and an amazing character and personality. But then he'd sort of suddenly go into a poem about Jimi Hendrix, you know, over some sort of free form music. So he was incredible, a real magnet, you know, a real sort of centre of... But so it wasn't long after the Criterion that... to be honest, I can't remember how it was that I sort of got to know Joe a little bit. It must have been from the Criterion gig, maybe just chatting to him afterwards. And then there was the Paradise Jazz Cellar and all that sort of scene too, which was a huge thing for me. Joe suddenly got another gig at the Criterion on Thursday night. There was a downstairs room.
Oh, okay.
Which was a smaller bar.
Right.
And I think it was maybe a little food served down there as well, and Joe was playing drums, and I think if it wasn't all the gigs, it was most of them. I think Steve Elphick was playing bass, and that was a hard gig for me though, because I was in my early 20s and I was like, Joe was calling tunes, you know, from
the 1940s.
Oh, you know, can you play Blue Dahlia? It's like, hello.
Your current trio, made up of Jonathan Zwartz on the bass and Hamish Stewart on the drums, does the origins of that stem back to the days of that Bondi jazz institution, the Starfish Club, or does it go back even further than that?
Well, with Jonathan, it goes back a little further than that. I had like an original jazz quartet sort of in the mid-80s, Jonathan, Sandy Evans, Tony Buck. That did lineup did sort of vary. And I'd met Jonathan a few years before that. Actually, when he first came over from New Zealand, I was sharing a house for a while with a piano player, organ, who's mainly an organ player these days, Mike Gubb. He was from New Zealand. We were at the con together, Mike and myself, and he knew Jonathan. And he was kind of involved in the same scene back in Wellington, I think it was. Yeah, and then so he introduced me to Jonathan. And Jonathan, at that point, hadn't even started playing double bass yet because he was basically a rhythm and blues electric bass player. He was yet to go to New York City. He came over with a band that, from memory, I think it was called the Crocodiles, and I think Jenny Morris was the lead singer. So I think they came over at the same time. And
what about Hamish?
Well, Hamish, I think I had met here and there. I hadn't really had the opportunity to play with him that much. But when the Starfish Club was really when we started to play a lot, that was every Monday night when it first started. And we did that for, I think, almost 2 years. And then it became a bit much to do that so consistently. And also the venue was difficult to maintain, so we kind of moved venues and changed it to one once a month, and then I sort of went overseas, and the Starfish Club sort of continued it was still going when I got back, but it shortly after sort of changed venues again and then sort of wound down. But definitely that was the time. I mean, I really got to know those two well, and Michael Bartolome was also.
This album, U-Tunes, of course, the moods swing from groove to group improvisation to even the South Pacific sound and influence, and a standard I hear, a rhapsody. The recording seems to have allowed the personalities to simultaneously stamp their mark, but also to allow the music to speak for itself. It's got feeling, it's got depth, it's textural rather than a recording space for virtuosity, for want of a better word. Can you describe what your aims were for this particular recording?
I haven't been asked that before. I was thinking, last time I did an album of original material just under my own name was about 10 years ago. And that was with a larger group. It was like piano, and with Phil Slater guested on that one, and Terrapie guested on snare drums, and it was Toby Hall and Lloyd Swanson and Barney McCall. Even though it was original music, it sort of had a fairly mainstream kind of feel. And when I'd finished the album and looked back at it, I thought, I don't know if this really kind of, I don't know if it's me. Like, I sort of, some of it is, but I think the most me was actually a tune written by Lloyd, to be honest, which was the bizarre thing. Mm. And I really loved that tune that he wrote and we played as a trio more than any other, really. I mean, I don't dislike a lot of it, but that one really spoke to me, and I thought when it came time, or I felt it was time to do another one, I kind of thought about that trio aspect and how much I enjoyed that track, and I thought sort of getting back to an essence, and I thought back to one of my first jazz albums was a guitar trio album, and then Jim Hall is one of my all-time favorite players, and he's mainly played as a trio, and Bill Frisell's another one of my all-time favourite players, and he's often mainly plays with a trio, especially these days. All of that was going through my head, and then I did a gig about a year and a half ago or so with Jonathan and Hamish, and it just gelled, and I thought, okay, I'm going to do it. I'm going to get these guys, and we're going to do it. I mean, I'm not really a virtuoso and never have been. I mean, there have been times when I've surprised even myself with what I've done. But, you know, I'm kind of a little bit inconsistent, and, you know, I can play quite well some nights, and other nights it's sort of, you know, I've kind of been working on that a bit. That's been one of my sort of things about self-improvement, sort of, is to bring that bottom level up more. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, that's just that journey that everyone goes through when you play an instrument. But so I wanted to kind of, like, make something that I thought was pretty much represented what I do or what I'd like to do, you know, and maybe gave me a sort of an indication of where I could go.
So this really points you in the direction now. You can see the horizon, say, some more trio?
Yeah, I mean, I could see myself adding, like, another instrument, but because now I've sort of done this to a degree, and I'd love to make another trio album, but I'm not sure if I should do it, follow one with the other.
Yeah.
It might be nice to kind of to break it up and come back. But then again, you know, the other great thing about a trio is it's so much easier to organise than anything else you can possibly imagine. I mean, organising a group of musicians who are kind of busy doing other things is, you know, it just exponentially sort of, one person is kind of easy, two people is probably twice as hard, three people is like factor it by another six or something, and then just keep going, you know, like four people, five people, unless you actually have like an actual band where everyone's kind of equal and sort of basically says, yep, let's do it, let's make ourselves available, let's put this as a priority. Generally speaking, when you're grabbing people, you kind of have to work within this framework of like, well, I've got this really great tour, you know, just at that time, can we change it? Especially when you're doing something for pretty much the first time. You know, I mean, you can grow to love a project, but you don't necessarily like it before you've actually done it, you know, and you don't necessarily give it your first priority. That's how I approached that album. Definitely the next one I would hope to have a working group that recorded, so I could do more arranging and do more sort of fine-tune some of the compositions. So I guess this one's fairly raw, and I think the next one I would just build on that, you know, try to keep certain elements, certain spontaneous elements, but also have more written parts. So the album kind of would have, a listening portion and a sort of improvised sort of sections.
Tim Rollinson, thanks very much for joining us in the studio.
Well, thanks for having me.